Okay, brethren, let's go back then to Ezra and chapter 5. Let's go begin in chapter 5. Actually, where we finished last time, let's just catch up. Let's reread the first few verses of Ezra chapter 5 that we finished with a month ago. So Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1. Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1. Then the prophets, Haggai the prophet, and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. The last time, as I just said in our recap, we had overviews of the books of these two prophets. And yes, in their Old Testament books, these two prophets did prophesy. He prophesied in the commonly accepted sense of the word. But throughout the Bible, both the Hebrew and the Greek words for prophet and prophesy can also mean preacher and preach. And I believe that this alternate meaning was the main sense in this instance, because it's very doubtful that the two prophets would have just given copies of their new purpose-written books to the Jewish leaders, you know, Zerubbabel and Yeshua, on the Lord's behalf, and just told them just to, you know, read them and act on them. I don't think they would have done that. No, because Haggai and Zechariah were right there in Judah, in Jerusalem, well, not actually in not in Jerusalem at the time, but in Judah with those Jewish returnees, I believe that they would have given them their inspired warning messages from the Lord in person, verbally. And from what we read last time, what the two prophets did give to the Jews was a severe but lovingly corrective tongue-lashing on behalf of the Lord God. Why? Because those returnee Jews and their leaders had given up way too easily at the command of the feeble King Bardia, at his command to halt their temple rebuilding work. And they'd apparently just kind of shrugged their shoulders, gave themselves a lame excuse, thinking or saying something like, oh well, you know, at least we tried. And they'd left Jerusalem and they'd gone back to their own hometowns around Judah, and they'd taken personal advantage of the halt in the temple rebuilding project, and they had resumed their own improvement work on their own houses. Okay, so the Lord God gave them some stern correction through those two prophets. How did the Jews respond to that stern correction? Verse 2. Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. Means they resumed the rebuilding of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So these two leaders, Prince Zerubbabel and the high priest Yeshua, who were commonly depicted as having been very righteous and solid and faithful, they would, at this point, have been somewhat very shamefaced, because it was they who must have led the Jews in their excessively easy capitulation to Bardia's command. And thus, without any recorded resistance to his halting of the super important temple rebuilding project, they just quit. But now, just like Zerubbabel's forefather David had so rightly done, both of them immediately pulled up their socks, confessed to the Lord what they and their fellow Jews had done wrong, repented of it, and eagerly returned to the job in hand. So yes, they got right to it, along with the support of the Lord's two prophets, still in verse 2, and with them were the prophets of God, Again, likely Haggai and Zechariah helping them. And again, the mere continued presence of these two prophets among the Jewish workers would likely have served as a kind of constant prod and warning from the Lord God for them never to slack off again. But, needless to say, Satan was still on the prowl. He was obviously miffed that the Lord's temple rebuilding project had been resumed following his, Satan's, first attempt at preventing it. And so, apparently not too long after the Jews' building work had resumed, along came another potential glitch in the guise of what I call the men from the ministry. not the church ministry, of course, but the local representatives of the new Persian king's government. Verse 3. At the same time came to them Tatnai, governor on this side the river, and Shethar-Boznai and their companions. So this Tatnai was King Darius's powerful provincial governor. Back in those days, they were called a satrap, S-A-T-R-A-P. You can look that up. And so this Tatnai was the provincial governor over all of the vast expanse of Darius's Persian territories west of the river Euphrates. So that was a huge slice of land that Darius was governor over. So it would have been something like King Charles's governor general. Oh no, it's called a lieutenant governor in the Canadian provinces. So it would have been like the lieutenant governor over British Columbia or Alberta, or I don't know whether you have a lieutenant. You probably don't have one over in Quebec, but we do here. Anyway, this Shethar-Boznai appears to have been Tatnai's vice governor, so his number two man. And what are called their companions here would have been members of their staff, and those would have accompanied the two, the governor and the vice governor, to Jerusalem, perhaps to add weight to their authority. So kind of interesting thought on this. If those officials had been long-time supporters of Darius, the new king, he likely would have brought them up with himself when he took the Persian throne. And he probably would have fired the satrap governor and staff of the former king, Bardia, and got rid of them. Anyway, here is Tatnai's opening salvo to the Jewish leaders, still in verse 3, and said thus unto them, asking this question, who has commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall? You know, it's kind of an interesting point that at that point in time, one wall of the new temple was so soon well ahead into its construction. And so those Jews had quickly heeded the Lord's recent warnings and as a result had not wasted any more time. But from Tatnai's point of view, because the temple rebuilding project had been halted by command of a Persian king, you know, even though that king had been the greatly despised Bardia, there was still a formal official illegality in what the Jewish leaders had done, in the Jewish leaders' decision to resume the temple building project. And it was illegal because, as all edicts of any and all Persian kings were to be continued in force until officially revoked, either by themselves or by one of their successors, officially, those Jews, well, they shouldn't have ordered done that. as they say. But the Jews had felt justified in disobeying Bardiya's decree. Why? Maybe partly because they may have, as others did, suspected that Bardiya had been an impostor, but mainly because they knew for sure, for absolute sure, that the commands of the Lord God took precedence over those of any human leader. You'll know from the New Testament that, as the Apostle Peter so correctly wrote many years later, we ought to obey God rather than men. We have to remember that, brethren, as time goes on. We ought to obey God rather than men. But going back to the story here, these men, these powerful men from the ministry, were right there in front of them asking this very inconvenient question. Who has commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall? It's interesting that Ezra did not record the Jews' actual reply here. He didn't. But we will see their reply in just a few verses' time. But it's the words of Tatnai, the Persian governor, that continue next in verse 4. Then said we unto them after this manner, what are the names of the men that make this building? Now, when we first read that, and you know, there's a lot of scholars been confused by this as well. This kind of reads as though it might have been Ezra writing these words on behalf of himself and his Jewish brethren as a response to Tatnai's question. But it wasn't, brethren. We'll prove that in a minute. It wasn't. And even it was, you know, if it was, it wouldn't have made any sense whatsoever. But it wasn't. So the we here, the we was not the Jews. It was Tatnai, the Persian governor, who was still speaking here. And so the we referred to himself, Tatnai, and his fellow Persian officials with him. And the them was referring to the Jewish leaders. This is going to come clear as Tatnai's words continue. Verse 5. But the eye of their God, okay, the Lord Yahweh, was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease till the matter came to Darius. And the implication here, which we'll see the details of in a minute, is that these Jewish elders had demanded that their case be escalated and taken to the new king, Darius, with the hope that he might be aware of Cyrus's decree through which the Lord had originally commanded the rebuilding of the temple. But there ends Tatnai's spoken words, and here resumes Ezra's narrative, still in verse 5. And then they, the Persian officials, returned answer by letter concerning this matter. And they returned answer not to the Jews, but to the mighty Persian king emperor, Darius. Verse 6. The copy of the letter that Tatnai, governor on this side of the river, in other words, west of the Euphrates, and Shethar Boznai and his companions, the Aphar-Sakites, which were on this side the river, sent unto Darius the king. Read that, and he does, you know, saying, why would they drag their supreme ruler, this king emperor, into this seemingly provincial matter? You know, you would think, you know, hadn't Darius far more important things to be dealing with rather than this seemingly minuscule issue? Also, you know, you would have thought that surely Tatnai would have possessed enough authority to be able to resolve this apparent local problem himself, wouldn't he? Well, apparently not, brethren. Apparently not. And we'll see why not once we get to see the details of Tatnai's letter, which begins right now. So they sent, verse 7, they sent a letter unto him, unto Darius, wherein was written thus. Ezra now quoting Tatnai's letter. Unto Darius the king, all peace. Apparently that was the common form of greeting in all such formal letters. Verse 8, be it known unto the king that we, in other words, Tatnai and his secondary officials, we went into the province of Judea to the house of the great God. That's interesting that these Gentiles would use such respectful terminology right here, to the house of the great God, which is builded with great stones, and timber is laid in the walls, and this work goes fast on and prospers in their hands. We read that, brethren, there seems to be a level of positive incredulity in Tatnai's description of the events here, as if he was truly impressed and even amazed, both at the quality of the building so far, the quality of the building work so far, and at the speed of the Jews' progress with it, almost miraculous how fast it was coming together. So next, in his letter, Tatnai tells King Darius what he and his staff had done so far about this apparent problem. He's actually repeating his initial question to the Jewish elders, which we read back in verse 3, verse 9 right now. Then asked we those elders and said unto them thus, who commanded you to build this house and to make up these walls? And then he repeated the second question, which we first read in verse 4. Now in verse 10, we asked their names also to certify you that we might write the names of the men that were the chief of them. So this fully clarifies any misunderstanding that anybody should have about verse 4 concerning who asked this question about the names. Okay. In those earlier verses, Ezra did not tell us the Jewish elders' answer to Tatnai's questions. But now, in Tatnai's letter, as he continues and gives us more details of his quote, of his conversation with the Jewish elders, we do at last see their reply. But the Jews' reply was not a short and sweet one. You know, they could have just said, God told us to do it. No, far from short and sweet, Zerubbabel and Yeshua deemed it necessary to provide a good bit of the background and some relevant history of the case in order for themselves to be able to get their point across much more effectively. Verse 11. And thus they, the Jewish elders, returned us answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth. I like that. I like that introduction, brethren. That's an introduction we might too imitate if and when it was ever to become necessary. We are the servants of the God of heaven and earth. That's what we want to be, brethren. We want to be the servants and the children of God, of the God of heaven and earth. Still in verse 11, and build. You know, we are rebuilding, they were saying, the house that was first builded these many years ago, which a great king of Israel builded and set up. That was Solomon, of course. Verse 12, but after our fathers had provoked the God of heaven unto wrath. You get that, brethren? That's interesting. You know, that was the number one reason for the Jewish exile and the number one reason for the temple's destruction. After our fathers had provoked the God of heaven unto wrath. Okay. Gave them, you know, gave their Jewish forefathers into the hand he, the God of heaven, gave them their Jewish forefathers into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this house and carries the people away into Babylon. Bang on, brethren, totally true. Verse 13, but in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Babylon, okay, no, it's not in Cyrus's first year as Persian king emperor, that was in 559 BC, but this is in the first year that Cyrus conquered and took over Babylon and became its king, and that was 20 years later in 539 BC. Still in verse 13, the same King Cyrus made a decree to build, to rebuild this house of God. Now this statement right here was the most crucially important one to this whole issue concerning the legality of this temple rebuilding project. Because again, the decrees of those Persian kings were considered so very important that they were to be considered as almost unchangeable, virtually cast in concrete. So, continuing, verse 14, and the vessels also of gold and silver of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem, and brought them into the temple of Babylon, the heathen temple of Babylon. These did Cyrus the king take out of the heathen temple of Babylon, and they were delivered into the one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he, Cyrus, had made governor. I think I might have mentioned this a couple of episodes ago, brethren, but there's a good possibility that that Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel may have been one and the same person. Why? Because both men are identified in the scriptures as governors of Judah. Both men are recorded in the scriptures as handling the temple vessels, and both men in the scriptures are recorded as having led the Jews return from the Babylonian exile, and so leading many Bible scholars to propose that they were in fact one and the same person, and with the Sheshbazzar perhaps having been the common, remember, the Babylonian kings and the Persian kings had a habit of renaming the Jews. So instead of Zerubbabel's actual name, he was given the name Sheshbazzar. Verse 15, and Cyrus said unto him, Sheshbazzar, take these vessels, go, carry them into the temple that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be builded in his place. So again, this statement from no less a personage than the much esteemed Cyrus the Great was a second crucially important one that would have authorized a temple rebuilding project. So next, Tatnai continues with his quotation of the Jews' history of their actions now following as a result of Cyrus's edict. Verse 16, then came the same Sheshbazzar, came here to Jerusalem, along with his party of able-bodied Jews, then came the same Sheshbazzar and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And since that time, even until now, has it been in building, and yet it is not finished. Brethren, it was nowhere even near finished. The remanufacture of the brazen altar and the relaying of the temple foundation was just about as far as they progressed before that earlier interruption from the Samaritans and their fellow Gentiles and to the old King Bardia. And that brief interruption had turned out to be only temporary, because the Lord God through his prophets Haggai and Zechariah, had spurred the Jews back into action, back into building action. And they quickly and zealously got back to work, and prior to this annoying and inconvenient arrival of Tatnai and his boys, they'd even got one wall completed. So there ended the Jewish elders' historical account of what had led up to this alleged problem, and it as accurately recorded in Tatnai's letter to King Darius. And Tatnai's letter to Darius now concludes with this request, verse 17. Now therefore, if it seems good to the king, let there be search made in the king's treasure house, in the provincial treasure house, which is there in Babylon, whether it be so, that a decree was made of Cyrus the king to build or rebuild this house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send his pleasure to us concerning this matter. So, whether this idea came from the Jewish elders or from the Persian ones, the suggestion was an excellent one. Let's do a search. Let's find out for sure. So now, as we move into chapter 6, brethren, the author, Ezra, leaves us to assume, A, that Tatnai's letter was sent to King Darius, sent post-haste, probably by courier, and B, that Darius quickly read the letter, because as we begin in verse 6, we see that he certainly had read the letter. Ezra chapter 6 and verse 1. Then Darius the king made a decree, and, as was suggested to him in Tatnai's letter, search was made in the house of the rolls. And the rolls were the scrolls or the books back in those days, where the treasures were laid up in Babylon. There's a couple more assumptions here that we have to make, brethren. First of all, that Darius was unfamiliar with Cyrus's famous decree. And that's on you, that's just strange. He was strangely unfamiliar. He didn't seem to know anything about Cyrus's famous decree. It was especially unusual because Cyrus was Darius's father-in-law. Secondly, another obvious assumption here was that Darius's searchers had no success with their first search in that house of the rolls, nor perhaps in other locations within Babylon or within Babylonia, where they had assumed that a copy of Cyrus's decree might have been found. And finally, the final assumption is that the searchers did not give up after their first failure, but they searched in other locations, even other cities within Babylonia, but even in other provinces of the Persian Empire, including the one where they were eventually successful. Now, we're not told how long those searches took, but at last, verse 2, there was found, not in Babylon, nor anywhere in the Persian's Babylonian province, but at Achmetha, in the palace that is in the province of the Medes, a roll, a scroll, a book, and therein was a record. And therein, you know, somewhere within that city was a record thus written. So somewhere in that city, somewhere in that scroll, that book, was a record thus written. Now this city called Achmetha was a city that was then actually called Ecbatana. You can look that up. Ecbatana, Ecbatana. Which was the much cooler summer capital of the Persian king emperors. And that city is the modern day city of Hamadan. You find that on Google Maps, which is located in a mountainous region of modern Western Iran. Now, just to be clear, just let me divert for a minute here, brethren. The kings of the Persian Empire, they actually used four major capital cities. And I know in a previous episode, I think it was last time, I said that they had two capitals. That wasn't correct. They actually had four major capital cities. Four capital cities, which they often had all operating at the same time in order to most effectively manage their vast empire. And I'll just tell you where the four capitals were. Number one was Susa, often referred to in the Bible as Shushan. I think we mentioned that last time. And that was the administrative capital, and it was in the west of the empire. Number two was Persepolis, and that was the ceremonial capital of Persia. Number three was Pasargadae. You can look, if you're interested, you can look these things up. And Pasargadae was the first initial founder capital, and it was perhaps only maintained as a capital for nostalgic reasons, maybe even superstitious reasons, I don't know. And then there was Ecbatana, which is in the Bible here called Achmita. Ecbatana, which again was the Persian king's popular and favorite summer residence, you know, it was like India, back in the 17th and 18th century, where the British Raj kept the capital and they moved it up into northern India, where it was much cooler, you know, because the heat in the other capitals was so oppressive. Okay, so in addition to those four, the city of Babylon was also acted as a kind of central hub. But it's amazing that the distance from the city of Babylon, where the search for a written copy of Cyrus's decree began, to Ecbatana, where it was eventually found, was a whopping 285 miles. And it was, you know, and then via a mountainous route, you know, to get there. So they really did put a lot of effort into finding that. So, and probably, you know, Darius told them, you know, don't give up. If you can't find it, you just keep on searching until you find it. Next begins Darius's direct quote of this written copy of the famous decree of his father-in-law, King Cyrus the Great. And it's interesting that Darius gives a more detailed version of it than the other versions that we find in the scriptures. So let's read it. Verse 3. In the first year of Cyrus the king, again, you know, not his first year as Persian king, but the first year after he'd conquered Babylon, the same Cyrus the king made a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Cyrus's decree then begins with its main command. Here it is. Let the house be builded. The place where they offered sacrifices. Please note that, brethren. Let the house be builded. The place where they offered sacrifices. Next, Cyrus's decree gets into some new detail, which we haven't seen before in the scriptures. And this is Cyrus's special instructions and specifications, you know, which we have not previously seen in previous biblical mentions of this decree that we've read. Still in verse 3. And let the foundations thereof be strongly laid, the height thereof 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 80 cubits. That's interesting. Now, some Bible scholars have looked at this, and they say that there are apparent problems with Cyrus's height and breadth specifications, because Cyrus's specs don't seem to match other records of them from Haggai, Zechariah, and from Ezra himself. However, both of these measurements evidently refer not to the whole temple building, but to what's written here, the place where they offered sacrifices, which means that they were literally referring to the temple's courtyard, in which the brazen altar stood and where the animal sacrifices were actually offered. Again, not to the whole temple building, you know, which might be implied by the English word height, you know, and the English word height was translated from the Chaldee word room, R-U-M-E. But that word room can mean length rather than height. And that would make much better sense, and better sense, and perhaps especially better sense to the opening words of the next verse. Verse 4, with 3 rows of great stones, a row of new timber. And brethren, that is exactly like the inner courtyard of the first temple, Solomon's first temple. You can turn there if you want, but I don't want you to lose Ezra 6. But in 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 36, talking about King Solomon's first temple is what it says. And he, King Solomon, built the inner court, the inner courtyard, with 3 rows of huge stones and a row of cedar beams. So, exactly the same. Cyrus was evidently just copying Solomon's original building specs. Okay, back to Ezra chapter 6, still in verse 4, changing the subject a little bit here. And let the expenses be given. Please note that, brethren. Given, not loaned, given. Out of the king's house, out of the royal treasury. And this very generous ongoing gift was likely only adhered to during the time that Cyrus reigned directly. It was probably abandoned once Cyrus was taken away to deal with foreign wars, and his son Cambyses, who was unfriendly towards the Jews, took over as regent and left the Jews to themselves to carry the financial load of the rebuilding project. Verse 5, and also, again, in Cyrus's edict here, let the golden and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took forth out of the temple, which is at Jerusalem, and brought unto Babylon, be restored obviously to the Levites, and brought again into the temple which is at Jerusalem, every one to his place, to the Lord's place, and place them in the house of God. And with that, Darius's more detailed quotation of Cyrus's decree concludes. Okay. So next, still in Darius's letter, Darius turns his attention to Tatnai turns his attention to his western provincial government officials then back in Judah. Verse 6. Now therefore, Tatnai, governor beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai, and your companions, the Aphorsachites, which are also beyond the river, be you far from thence. Be you far from thence. Thence, brethren, being Jerusalem. So, in other words, Darius was commanding them, get yourselves out of there. Verse 7, let the work of this house of God alone. let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God in his place, in the Lord's place. Interesting that both Darius and Cyrus reverently, reverentially, respectfully, and repeatedly referred to the Jerusalem temple as the house of God. And that implies a certain level of belief that the Lord Yahweh was the one true God. You might remember, brethren, from last time, Ezra back in chapter 1, quoting Cyrus as dogmatically stating that he is the God. Remember him saying that? Next, King Darius makes another decree, a second one, a secondary decree, but an equally generous one that was directly associated with his first decree. And he assigned this decree directly to Tatnai and his subordinates for them to make sure that all of this was carried out just as he had commanded. Verse 8, moreover, I make a decree what you shall do to or for the elders of these Jews for the building of this house of God, that of the king's goods, again, even of the tribute beyond the river, in other words, from the local tax coffers of Persia's western provinces, forthwith, in future, in perpetuity, expenses be given, not loaned, given unto these men, that they be not hindered. So this second decree effectively restored Cyrus's original ultra-generous contribution, which Darius had quoted from Cyrus's decree back in verse 4. And even more, not just money, in addition to the money, verse 9, and that which they have need of, both young bullocks and rams and lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven. And again, brethren, the God of heaven. Once again, please note Darius's respectful terminology. And wheat and salt and wine and oil, according to the appointment of the priests which are at Jerusalem, let it be given them. Again, not loaned, given them, day by day, without fail, in perpetuity. Verse 10, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet savours unto the God of heaven. Again, all of this, brethren, again, in emulation of Cyrus's original gifts. And amazingly, just like Cyrus, Darius possessed an apparently God-inspired deep desire to have an integral part in the Jews' sacrificial offerings to the Lord God. But, and we have to smile here, with one somewhat humorous stipulation, still in verse 10, and pray for the life of the king and of his sons. We have to get a smile out of this added verse. You know, Darius apparently seeking fair advantage from all that he was giving them. Okay, but now, finally, Darius gets serious again with a very stern warning. Verse 11, also I have made a decree. Okay, so there's a third decree now, brethren. Not degree, third degree. A third decree. Decree. Again, directly linked to his first and second decrees, that whosoever shall alter this word, let timber be pulled down from his house and being set up, in other words, being rebuilt into a scaffold, let him be hanged thereon, and let his house be made a dunghill for this, for committing such an awful crime. Verse 12, and the God that has caused his name to dwell there, you know, to dwell there in the Jerusalem temple, destroy all kings and people that shall put to their hand to alter and to destroy this house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So please notice, brethren, that Darius applied and extended this warning not just to the citizens of his own Persian Empire, but to any and all kings and people, so seemingly invoking a kind of open-ended prophetic curse, which would hopefully on Darius's part, be brought to pass by the Lord God upon anyone who would dare to do such a thing. And yes, even if that thing was done in the far future. And it was, brethren, nearly 600 years later in 70 AD. Okay, yes, it was by the Lord's perfect will and timing, we know, that his second physical stone temple, having been repeatedly desecrated by the Jews, was totally razed to the ground by the Romans. Okay, again, yes, actually and militarily by the Romans, but just like the Babylonians 7 centuries earlier, the Romans were merely used by the Lord God as pawns to do his will in order to punish the Jews for their again repeated rebellion against himself. We read this, brethren, and we might then wonder whether or not the ensuing centuries after 70 AD, the ensuing centuries of demise, both of the Jews and of the Roman Empire as well, eventually, the demise from any significant level of international power might have been a partial fulfillment of Darius's curse, as backed up by the Lord God himself, that the Lord God may have respected that so-called curse and brought it to pass. Following that final warning and curse, the powerful King Darius then concludes with a super strong finish. Still in verse 12, I, Darius, have made a decree. Brethren, a cast in concrete royal Persian decree, let it be done with speed.